Hello, this is 93.3 CFMU, and you're listening to The Musings, where we talk about medical humanities, and today we will be covering patient autonomy. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan, and this is my other host.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sierra. Jordan, how are you feeling today about this episode?
Well, it's my first episode, so I'm a little bit nervous. Hands are a little sweaty. How about you?
Sam, honestly. First episode over here, too.
Okay, awesome. So, you know, me and Sierra, we both come from a science background, right? Yeah. We're both students here at McMaster. And, you know, we're talking about patient autonomy today, and it's not really something that we cover in a lot of our classes, right?
No, I feel like it's more knowledge-based about more about treatment or about sciences in general, but it doesn't really focus as much on the humanities aspects compared to the science.
Exactly, right? So, you know, a lot of undergraduate students in sciences are likely pursuing some sort of profession in the medical field, and it's crazy that, you know, patient autonomy and the rights of the patients are sometimes neglected in our learning in our undergrad, right? So, I guess we can just dive right in. So, Sierra, what do you know about patient autonomy right now?
I know certain terms like DNR, I know about medically assisted death, Good Samaritan Act, things like that, but I feel like I lack a level of depth about those topics. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Honestly, I'm the exact same as you, and I think it's a great reason why, you know, we can kind of have this conversation, get a little bit more informed about patient autonomy, and inform our listeners. So Let's dive right in. So, you know, before we kind of get started, we are going to define what patient autonomy is. Okay, so patient autonomy is the right of patients to make informed choices about their own healthcare, right? I think that's pretty important, right, Sierra?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, and then, so another aspect of patient autonomy is it emphasizes respect for individuals' capacity to make decisions about their lives and their bodies, recognizing their right to consent or refuse treatment based on their values, beliefs, and preferences. So there are three main types of consent under patient autonomy. Would you mind sharing one of those, Sierra?
Yeah, the first one I'm thinking of is called informed consent. So essentially, the healthcare providers need to obtain this consent before providing medical treatment. And it basically just includes giving them the appropriate information to know about their diagnosis and treatment before proceeding.
Awesome. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? That's how they're going to get the best outcomes. So then I can cover another one. So another form of consent is the capacity to consent. Patients must have the capacity to understand the information provided and make decisions about their care. If a patient is deemed incapable of making decisions due to factors such as age, illness, or cognitive impairment, a substitute decision maker must be appointed. This could be a family member, spouse, trusted friend, or companion, right? I feel like this is very important, especially because if somebody isn't in the right state of mind and they still want to have the best health outcomes, you want to have a loved one or a trusted family or friend to make that decision to allow you to have the best outcome, right?
I agree. Consent is super important. So just because someone might not be in the state to consent doesn't mean that we should throw their consent completely out the window.
Awesome, for sure. And then the final one is the right to refuse. So the act affirms that patients have the right to refuse medical treatment, even if refusal might result in harm. So this is a little controversial, but additionally, the healthcare provider is required to respect the patient's decision as long as the patient has the capacity to make the decision. So, yeah, I think this is very important because, you know, even if you feel like the thing might result in harm, but it may be a lot of people could neglect or go against getting a specific treatment because it could go against religious or cultural beliefs, right? Okay, so now we're going to kind of, you know, dive into the deep end and cover a pretty controversial topic. We're going to talk about DNR, so do not resuscitate. And Sierra, I'll let you talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, I feel like talking about the right to refuse before this was also a great choice because this really relates to it. DNR is a do not resuscitate disorder. Order. And this directly relates to patient autonomy, and it is another topic that's really important to look into because it is a medical order that a patient makes, and they're indicating a preference to not be resuscitated. So this could be by chest compressions, defibrillation, and breathing machines. They're basically opting out, and they're saying that if there is a situation where they require resuscitation, they do not want it at all. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, thanks for that, you know, that brief overview that helped me understand a little more. And honestly, I think that, you know, you can see it from both sides where there are reasons why somebody would opt for DNR and there are also reasons why somebody would not, right? So, I mean, I personally think that if you're, you know, a little bit older or you have a terminal illness or some sort of chronic disease that, you know, is causing you a lot of distress and, you know, you happen to pass away or you happen to die and you have that, I would understand that, right? But for, you know, for healthy young people who have that order, you know, that confuses me a little bit. What's your take on that?
I understand why others could be confused on that because it is such like a decision-based and such an opinion-based topic. Mm-hmm. I feel like when it comes to maybe these younger scenarios, the thing that comes to my mind is the burden of the family. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they know they're going to need a lot of extra help and support after they receive the treatment, they might think that's going to be too much of a burden on their family for whatever situations they're experiencing or they're aware of. So maybe they would choose to take the DNR route instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. And I think that sheds light on kind of both sides why the pros and cons of DNR. Do you have anything else to add, you think, on DNR? Or
I think we're good to move on to the next topic. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think that covered DNR. Okay, so now we can talk a little bit about, you know, why patient autonomy is important and how it can lead to the best outcomes for patients. So in order to have the best outcomes for patients, specifically through informed consent, it's really important for physicians to, you know, accurately detail the prognosis and information, you know, implications to their patients, right? Would you not agree?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so an example of this could be, you know, wanting to have the best outcome for certain chronic diseases that people might live with, such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes or other chronic, whether it's skin, like skin conditions, rashes, autoimmune, such as eczema, right? So informed consent is like the physician informing the patients about lifestyle changes, medication adherence, and, you know, ways to manage it is going to lead to better outcomes because if the patient is informed from the physician, they're going to be able to adhere to those protocols and have a better outcome.
Right? I agree because it's really important with informed consent because sometimes in cases, for example, surgery is not the main option you need. Mm-hmm. You can manage or alleviate the pain and kind of wait and maybe get back to surgery if that's what you require. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to let everybody know their choices, not just the one choice you want to give them or the one choice you might think is best, because it really varies by the person and their lifestyle and ultimately their lived experiences.
Yeah, exactly. The life stage that they're in is going to, and I guess like their mindset, it's all going to dictate the type of outcome they want whether it's a surgery or like a treatment, whatever it might be. Yeah, their life stage, how old they are, what they want, right? So there's examples where some people, especially if they're in the like an older end stage of their life, they might not, let's say they get a diagnosis of cancer, they might not want to opt for aggressive treatments such as chemotherapy or, you know, radiation. They might opt for a more palliative care route where they prioritize, you know, comfort as opposed to, you know, a lot of stress and struggle that goes with those aggressive treatments, right?
Yeah, I agree. I feel like that's a really good example to paint the picture of informed consent because it's very straightforward, but it's also very meaningful and very important.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Okay, so now we can kind of cover some examples of when patient autonomy is very, very important, but there are certain circumstances where, you know, it'd be like a car accident, for example, and they're getting rushed into the ER. They're not in a state or they're not with their loved ones or their parents, and they don't really, you know, if they're running on a clock, they don't have a lot of time, they need to make a quick decision. What do you think they should be doing in a situation like that, Sierra?
It's really hard because they're still ultimately in the state of shock. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard when you're in a state of shock and someone comes up to you and says, hey, you need to make this choice right now. You have option A or you have option B. Mm-hmm. So if I was in that situation, if I'm being honest, I don't even know what I would do. I'm just getting stressed out thinking about it. Yeah. But I guess it really depends on the circumstance. I know that's not the answer you want to hear because you want more depth, but that's really all I can give at this point.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. It totally depends on the circumstance. And I guess in that specific example, it, you know, that's a lot of pressure on the physician or the whoever's attending to that person. And, you know, that's also why there's like the Good Samaritan Act as well, because even in those certain circumstances where you feel that you're doing the right thing to try and help that person, you're protected under a specific law. So examples of, you know, when you have to make those decisions would be surgery. If somebody had a punctured lung, they, you know, a physician, the doctor needs to make that decision right away. And oftentimes they will, you know, they will opt for surgery because they want, you know, as a physician, your job is you want to save the patient's life. You don't want to, you can't overthink those specific things, right? That's, you got to be a quick decision maker. Yeah. And yeah, so I would 100% agree that, yeah, it is situation dependent, but oftentimes they do lean more towards, you know, surgery or whatever means they need to save the patient's life.
Yeah, and another really important thing about the Good Samaritan Act that I just thought of is it doesn't necessarily apply to, you know, being in the ER, even in a hospital. It can also apply to individuals on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Say if I'm on the street or I'm on campus and I come across someone who is unconscious and not breathing, I would be protected if I went and appropriately administered CPR, which could save their life. It could really make it or break it, depending on the context.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to also understand that individuals at the scene of an accident who provide emergency first aid to people who are injured, ill, or unconscious due to an accident or other emergency are actually protected under the Good Samaritan Act as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, 'cause somebody could just as easily, even though they might be trained, just walk past somebody unconscious, whether, you know, if you're CPR trained, like a lifeguard, for example, or physicians, right? You could see somebody and you could just walk past them. So I think it's great that they have the Good Samaritan Act to almost, it is to protect, but it is also to sort of promote people to even to engage in those specific things, right? If there wasn't a law saying, so let's say you went and you tried to resuscitate them and you're unsuccessful, unfortunately the person passed away, you would, if there wasn't the Good Samaritan, you would get charged, right? It would,
yeah.
You'd be at fault. So, yeah, no, I think the Good Samaritan Act is definitely something I can stand behind.
Yeah, there are very rare cases where it hasn't worked in someone's favor, but it's important to mention these cases are from years ago, so the rules and regulations around Good Samaritan Act has slightly changed. For example, we did look at this one case where it was the Lisa Torti case, where she got in a car accident, unfortunately, and pulled her friend, Alexandra Van Horn, out of the car. But pulling her actually resulted in an injury leading to paralysis, which did result in a lawsuit that didn't go in Lisa Torti's favor. And she tried to take action, but she didn't really do the appropriate action and didn't work out in her favor. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I personally think that, you know, she was trying her best and, you know, sometimes things happen, right? And I also, this is also an anomaly. I don't think this is the common thing that happens when somebody tries to administer help, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're knowledgeable and you're trained, right? So, you know, I think it's very unfortunate, but I think she did the right thing to try and help and to try and engage, because if she didn't, for all we know, it could have been a worse outcome for the person she was trying to save, right? How about you?
I agree. I also feel like things related to spinal injuries are also less aware to people who have no background in first aid training. So we also have to take into consideration, what is her expertise? What did she know? She was just trying to save her friend at the end of the day, not administer, for example, a medical procedure, treatment she was fully unaware of and out of line to do. And the ruling for this was really close. It was a 4-3 ruling as well. So it is a very split back and forth topic.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Awesome. And yeah, I don't really have anything more to add on Good Samaritan. Do you, Sierra?
I don't think so. Do you want to talk about religious implications now?
Yeah, for sure. So I think something that a lot of you guys might be familiar with is Jehovah's Witness and how they go against blood transfusions. So this is something in the religion from the Bible, actually, a verse that says, it's in Acts, that says they should abstain from blood. So they interpreted this as, yeah, you got to stay away from blood transfusions. And, you know, this is very controversial. Would you all agree, Sierra?
I agree. It's a highly controversial topic.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, actually, you found an example of something with Jehovah's Witness. Would you mind sharing a little bit about
that?
Yeah,
of course. So Essentially, this case took place in Quebec in 2016, and when it comes to blood transfusions and Jehovah's Witnesses, it is a pretty known case because, as I mentioned, highly controversial. Mm-hmm. And it follows a woman named Eloise, who was 27, who unfortunately ended up dying to multiple organ failure from complications with a C-section she had. And she was reminded by staff that basically blood transfusions were her only option, and due to being a Jehovah's Witness, she declined every single time. And it even came to the point where they tried urging her own family members to, you know, help make a decision or talk her out of it. But her family members also said the same thing. Mm-hmm. Jehovah Witnesses cannot accept blood transfusions. So as I mentioned, it did unfortunately result in her death. But it's really important to understand that this was her consent. This was her choice. It was due to a religious matter, which is a really deep issue. Not issue, but issue when it comes to healthcare and the theme of patient autonomy that sometimes people are unable to grasp, if you try to get what I'm saying. I know it's kind of jambled.
Yeah, no, yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that is a, you know, these are very, like, exceptional cases where these type of things happen. And, you know, the doctors are going to try and do as much as they can. But typically when, yeah, there is a religious or like a cultural barrier that might prevent them from providing the full treatment, it does make it difficult. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of behind the scene things that are happening to lead somebody to, you know, make that decision, right? So I think that's also why informed consent is really important, because without informed consent, she would have been given those blood transfusions, right? But yeah, because, you know, she had the ability to have informed consent and to reject them because she was standing strong in her religious beliefs. I think, you know, religion is very important, and I think that she was staying true to her beliefs and her family as well. Yeah. Is, you know, it's a big statement to, you know, the strength, I guess, of Jehovah Witnesses beliefs. But I also at the same time think that it is a little, it, you know, she almost sacrificed her life just to stay true to her belief. So, you know, that sometimes is, you know, a little bit of a brain teaser for me. But how about you? What do you think, Sierra?
Well, I do think, too, legally, she is protected. It's not like she broke the law or did anything wrong, because the Quebec Civil Code clearly states that, quote, an adult who is conscious and of sound mind has the right to either accept or refuse medical treatment. Mm-hmm. And in this case, she ultimately refused it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look into cases of minors, the outcome might go another way.
Mm.
For example, I looked at a case, also I believe it was in Quebec, of a 14-year-old cancer patient who also needed a blood transfusion, but things went differently because they are a minor. So the doctor took this to court and basically said, we need permission in case it becomes life-threatening to give blood transfusions because she's refusing it. And the court actually did let the doctor override her request because she was a minor and not an adult, even though she was in a complete sound state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I understand that. And I think in certain circumstances, for when it's life-threatening, that, you know, I can agree with that. But any other, if it's not a life-threatening thing, the doctor should not be able to override even a minor's, you know, informed consent for a specific procedure, right? So I guess we can also cover, or do you have anything else to add for Jehovah's Witness?
I feel like we really summed it up, and I feel like the case examples were also really good for the viewers to kind of understand it from a more applied application.
For sure. So I guess we can cover another religious example is, so everybody kind of knows about Ramadan, right?
Yes.
So there's fasting, so they do it for a month, and there was an example where after a car accident, a patient who needed an IV inserted, but it was during Ramadan, so he was fasting, and he was very strong in his belief, so he refused to get the IV serum to avoid breaking his fast, and he actually prefaced that he would rather die fasting than break his religious observance or break his obedience to his religion. So, you know, yeah, what are your thoughts on that decision?
I think this is really interesting because it's really different. I feel like when it comes to religious beliefs, we all kind of jump to thinking about the Jehovah Witnesses case because it's more public, like it's in TV shows, it's in the media, but we don't ever get to see situations like this. So I'm honestly a little bit confused because this is new to me. I don't really know what I think of it, because I do understand that it's from a religious standpoint, and religion mm-hmm. is very, very important, obviously. But I also, sometimes it confuses me mm-hmm. on the choices, because it's a life or death situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more serious. I feel like I don't know what to think. Well, actually,
in this specific example, it didn't preface that it was like he could have died, but it was him getting this IV and this serum was essential for like a proper recovery for him. So I do understand that, you know, he wants to avoid breaking his fast. But the one thing I do know about Ramadan is you are able to actually make up any days that you end up breaking your fast. And it's as, you know, most religions, there are some people who are a little bit more like kind of strict. So, you know, I think it's a statement that he was very strong in his beliefs. And, you know, I'm kind of the same with you. It's confusing. It's hard to kind of grasp these decisions, but I guess when we try and interpret these, we have to think in the shoes of the person making that decision, right? We can't use our outside knowledge. We kind of have to think of what were they thinking in that moment? And, you know, they have a different understanding and background of what they would decide to do in that circumstance. So, you know, I would understand both sides of why he would accept or refuse, but, you know, I'm a very big defender of, you know, trying to have the best health outcomes possible. Yeah. So, you know, as I respect, you know, in Jehovah's Witness not getting blood transfusions, or in Ramadan, you know, not receiving the IV and like the nutrients and minerals in there that would break the fast, it is still, like I said before, a little confusing, because you would think that they're like, them surviving is their like most important thing to them, right? As them staying alive. But, you know, I guess it just shows that like we don't really know necessarily what's happening in other people's lives and what's going on. So we always have to consider the pros and cons, right?
Yeah, and I really liked how you mentioned that, because I feel like it links back to the whole goal and topic of our episode. That's why patient autonomy is so complex, because mm-hmm. there's so many different perspectives, there's so many cases, so many sides that have so many different outcomes, but it all falls under the umbrella of the main theme, patient autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when it comes to religion, like, we just do need to understand, and it needs to be made more aware that you can't really fix it because it's the religious view. It's not going to change, and it's understandable. It's important to respect mm-hmm. and understand other people's religions.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, we need to find a way to maybe compromise, or maybe make the impact not as bad mm-hmm. if we want to get to, you know, giving the appropriate health care. We can't mm-hmm. override this decision, because at the end of the day, legally, they're in their full right to say no because of their religion.
Exactly. So I guess we can talk about one more talking point before we wrap up.
Sounds good.
I know you did some work on MAID. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Yeah. So MAID basically stands for Medical Assistance in Dying. And it's used to help people who are able to receive assistance from a medical practitioner to end their life. It's not like anybody. I feel like a huge misconception is that people think that anybody can go and say, oh, I'm just going to get MAID, which is why a lot of people are against it.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not the case. Firstly, the criminal code does allow for this to occur if very specific circumstances and rules are met. But there is criteria to do it. And if you don't meet all elements of the criteria, you can't get MAID. Do you want mm-hmm. to touch more upon that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think with MAID, it is, like you said, it's a very controversial topic, and there are a lot of people against it, but I think it's because they're not fully educated on exactly what it is. So they just think that, you know, like you said, anybody can just go and say, hey doc, can I get MAID? Like, all right, I don't want to live anymore, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's not true at all. So I think that the fact that they need to meet a specific criteria, but my only kind of comment to that would be, do you think that people who want MAID would ever like lie on that specific criteria that, you know, they may be like, what exactly is the criteria they have to meet? Is it physical assessments, or is it, you know, written assessments, verbal assessments? How does a physician evaluate a person on a MAID?
That's a really good question. So I can actually go over the criteria.
Sure.
So firstly, you need to be eligible for health services funded by a province or a territory or the federal government. And You also are eligible if you meet your province's or territory's minimum period of residence, or what they call a waiting period. You also need to be an adult, so you need to be at least 18 years old, and you also need to be mentally competent. You also need to, that basically just means you need to be able to make your own healthcare decisions. Mm-hmm. You also need to be able to give informed consent. As you mentioned, informed consent, super important. You need to be able to make a voluntary request for medical assistance in dying, which basically means nobody can pressure you and say, hey, you have to go and say you want MAID. Like, it has to come fully from yourself. And you do need to have a medical condition that, you know, is irreversible or something that is severe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So I guess because it does say you need to be at least 18 years old and mentally competent, do you think that, and I don't know if there's a statistic on this, but has there been an increase in the young amount of people who have received MAID, or is it, because I know it might just be mostly older people potentially?
That's a really good question. Unfortunately, I don't think I'm going to be able to answer that, because that is really good. Mm-hmm. That's a very complex thing, and I feel like we would need to dive a little more deeper. Mm-hmm,
for sure. Yeah, so, I mean, I think the most common is it's typically older people, or, you know,
I would agree.
It's people in a severe amount of distress where they feel that, you know, they can't do it much longer, right? So, in those specific instances, I mean, I see it would be very devastating for family members and loved ones, but you also have to see it from the point of view of the patient, right? Because nobody wants to be chronically suffering, right? That's not a life being fulfilled, right? So is there any other things you kind of want to add on that?
I did want to add one more thing, if that's okay.
For sure.
Another reason why I feel like a lot of people are against it is because of the new regulations regarding mental health. A lot of people also think that anybody can just go up and say, hey, due to my mental health, I'm going to request MAID. Once again, that's not true. And also, I did see this thing online that if your only medical condition is mental health, you are not eligible for medical assistance in dying, apparently, until 2027. Which I didn't even know.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I did not know that either. Well, that's a very important point then, right? That's very important. Because honestly, up till now, I didn't know that was a thing either. I thought with the new regulations on mental health that it was a little bit more laid back with some of that. But yeah, no, that definitely clears that up. So I guess, yeah, we're kind of approaching the end of our show now. So is there any further things you kind of want to add, Sierra?
I think I just really wanted to sum it up and say patient autonomy is a really complex topic. We would really like for you to kind of sit back, digest everything, and kind of reflect on what we've mentioned about this podcast. I feel like we brought up some really great perspectives, really great thoughts, and we really tried to like fully understand every circumstance, which I really appreciate. And mm-hmm. I really had a great time hosting this with you.
Yeah, awesome. So, and I 100% agree. And don't just take everything that we say, like do your own research, like look more into this. It's a complex topic. There's, you know, a 30-minute podcast isn't going to sum it all up for everybody. So do your own research, look into it, especially on things that, you know, we weren't fully able to cover because they are very controversial, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, likewise here, I had a great time podcasting with you. Thank you for listening to The Musings on Patient Autonomy, and we'll see you next time.